now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. Today, what's next for Manchester United after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's sacking? Is he really the one to shoulder all the blame? We'll assess the new manager bounce at Norwich, Newcastle and Aston Villa. Arsenal are their own worst enemy at Liverpool. And could Roy Keane come back to management soon? This is The Game. Welcome back once again. I'm Hugh Woozencroft alongside Gregor Robertson and Tom Roddy for this edition of the Game Podcast. And the inevitable has finally happened. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been sacked by Manchester United after their 4-1 defeat at Watford. The club have won just one of their past seven Premier League games, seventh in the table right now, 12 points behind the leaders. First team coach Michael Carrick has been placed in temporary charge, caretaker, I guess, while United seek an interim manager until the end of the season before they appoint a new permanent manager. So that's exactly how things are going at Old Trafford. But we've got to talk about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to begin the podcast, who I think, you know, we can all say this is a sad moment for him because he clearly loves Manchester United. He put his heart and soul into it. He just, I don't think, was up to the job. Do you think, though, Tom, that he leaves with his head held high? You went to the game at Vicarage Road at the weekend.
Yeah, I think he does leave with his head held high because of that interview, really. He did this, if you haven't seen it, it's definitely worth a watch, all 11 minutes of it, because you really sort of feel the emotion. And it was really appropriate as well, I felt, because I was sat at Vicarage Road and I felt extremely uncomfortable with the chanting of Ollie's at the wheel from the Watford fans. And he'd just become a symbol of mockery and taunted, and that wasn't why he was brought in there. He was brought in at this moment to be an interim manager until the end of the season, and the reaction of the United fans at the end was understandable because it was a horrendous performance. It really was, and we'll get into that. It was a horrendous performance, but you sort of felt this isn't. It is his fault to an extent, but he shouldn't have been there that long. He should have been gone long ago. I mean, I think way long ago. He should have done the interim role, and that was it. He should have been gone then, because there were the limitations, and we knew that, and we've seen it the whole way through. There have been ups and downs, but we've seen the limitations the whole way through, and this had been dragging on for so long that it felt like a real sort of mourning process. And I don't think his reputation at the club isn't, I don't think it's damaged by this period at all for what he's done, but it was torturous for him. You could see it in his face, absolute torture for him. I think knowing the person he is, and you saw that in the interview. I mean, he's close to tears. He's in tears, isn't he? You know, in this interview, you know how much this meant to him, and to be taunted that way, to feel that you've you're being told you're sort of failing, and you've made the club a mockery. God, I can't imagine the emotions he was going through.
I agree with you. I think he does leave with his head held high. I think you're right. The interview underlines what a very good person he is. Loads of us in the media that have dealt with him would have said that. Compared to many of the other people we deal with, he is really a top bloke, if you want to put it that way. But he loves Manchester United. I think from a fan perspective, you never wanted it to come like this, and you almost felt the more he was left in charge, it would eventually come to this. And I don't think it was necessary. I agree with you. There were multiple occasions at which the club should have moved on. I think most people, that was a 5-0 defeat against Liverpool a few weeks ago. Do you agree? Ole Gunnar Solskjaer leaves the club, not just with his head held high, but as he said in that interview, he leaves the club in a better place than when he arrived.
With much of his tenure, I was kind of conflicted by the interview as well. Anyone with a kind of any semblance of humanity would feel some sympathy for him. He was clearly very emotional. But I really think the only reason he leaves with his head held high is, like everyone's saying, he's a good guy. And because he was wildly underqualified for the job in the first place. So you can't really criticise him for Manchester United's current plight, because he should never have been Manchester United manager in the first place. So I also felt a bit like it was quite peculiar that he was really saying his ultimate achievement was creating a good environment. I made Man United somewhere that the players enjoy coming to work again. Like, that is some major achievement for a manager of Manchester United. You know, it was a bit of an open goal after Jose Mourinho. He came in, lightened the mood, and you saw the immediate response when it kind of that faded, and you got into the nuts and bolts of what a manager needs to do to affect the team on a match day. That's when you started to see the cycle that we've spoken about so much on this podcast, of kind of peaks and troughs. So, yeah, it kind of follows the same.
That's
the same narrative as as his whole time at the club. It's there's a lot of conflicting feelings with seeing him depart, but ultimately it's the right thing for him and it's the right thing for Manchester United.
If Solskjaer is not totally to blame, I'm going to go through some of the other areas that we think could have caused this. I've got to begin with the executive vice chairman Ed Woodward, Tom, and his leadership of the club. We know he should be departing very, very soon, and he will have a bit of a handover period after that as well. And maybe that's the reason, by the way, that there is going to be an interim boss, it seems, at Old Trafford. How much is he to blame? Maybe not just for, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's time in charge, but getting the club to this point.
Partially, but I think this goes back, it goes even higher than Ed Woodward, doesn't it? You know, the Glazers bought the club for profit. That was why they bought it. And with Woodward, I mean, the interesting thing is what's going to happen. You said there that there might be an extended period, but there is an idea or the suggestion that he might end up in a consultancy role at United. I mean, maybe the writing was on the wall at Vicarage Road as well, that the only person there was John Alexander, who left the club in 2017, I think, club secretary, left the club in 2017. And he is in a consultancy role now at the club. And you just think, it seems to be this cycle of people who are part of the club, but still stick around. And it's that, I understand holding on to the past and making the most of that, but this club has to move on. It has to move on, and it hasn't. It isn't.
For me, as a Manchester United fan, I don't mind people staying in consultancy roles or giving advice when they want to leave the role when they've been a success. When David Gill left Manchester United and said, I can still help you out with transfers, and if you still want me to do some of the, you know, networking stuff that I did when I was in charge, then I'm happy to do that for a fee. I don't mind. He was great. It's fine. When you've been abject failures, you know, I got slated for saying, I can't believe Ed Woodward's going to be in a consultancy role. So many people responded to me saying, this is an everyday thing. It's an everyday thing when the person leading has been good, and you want to have that element of transition where this person can guide you, your new person in charge, for a few months because they've been great at the job. When they've been terrible, see you later. Here's your check. Goodbye. I never want to see you again, to be perfectly honest, or we'll give you some free tickets to whenever you want to come. But as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing for Manchester United to learn from Ed Woodward, in my opinion, apart from branding deals. Brilliant. No. This guy has been fantastic on commercial deals.
Yeah.
The football side of it has been catastrophic.
Yeah.
He hasn't got a decent piece of advice to give in terms of the football side. I'm sorry. And that is from the moment Sir Alex Ferguson left until now. I don't want him to have a transition with whoever will be taking over the football side of the club. Branding deals, yes, whoever you know, whichever new pen or watch sponsor or whatever it is. But no way should this guy be giving any advice about football to Manchester United.
Also, going back to your question, Hugh, and connected to the situation with Solskjaer, Woodward got caught up in the emotion of Solskjaer being a success, and this guy who's gonna, he's connected to the history of the club, and he's going to reconnect to the club. And this is part of why I say I think it should have come to an end at the end of that season. Thank you, right man, right time. You've done the job. You've sorted it out after Mourinho. And you see that in other clubs where they have the people in charge have the foresight of how things are going to work out. Brighton, for example, everyone thought getting rid of Chris Hughton was a strange idea at the time. And now you see it, Graham Potter and what he's doing there, brilliant decision. But Woodward got caught up in the excitement and the success of what Solskjaer had brought. And the problem was then they almost got trapped in this position where you can't let go of him, but it's harder to let go of him. And again, I mean, this is even forgetting the fact he got given a new contract, what, 4 or 5 months ago, Solskjaer? That's just another sign of someone who just doesn't understand football, the football side.
What about the players, Gregor? No, because honestly, as a Manchester United fan, there was one thing that really annoyed me, and it got highlighted at the weekend. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer went over, he held his hands up to the Manchester United fans, who were clearly very, very angry with the 4-1 defeat. And almost in tears, Bruno Fernandes says, no, don't boo him, boo us. It's on us. It's on the players. And you watch the actual game, and Bruno Fernandes is pointing for his teammates to run where he should be running. Bruno Fernandes is histrionics, arms in the air when things don't go his way. The lack of quality, the lack of endeavour, the lack of intensity, the lack of fight. And you're sort of saying, what are you so upset about? You had your opportunity for the last 90 minutes and you did nothing with it. And now you're telling them, no, boo me. And it's like, well, unless you want to be booed, unless you get off on that, I don't know why you would have played that way. And then, of course, the apologies come on social media.
Oh, my God. That was what it was.
And you just say, I mean, come on. Again, I don't know. You know, we're going to hear about Roy Keane a little bit later on. I don't know if there's a lack of character in the changing room at Manchester United, or honestly, for me, a bunch of players who think they're a lot better than they are, actually. A lot of players who think they are the mustard and they're not. And their levels dropped because they thought they finished last year second. They felt that they were guaranteed to be in the top four, if not push for the title. And they haven't done all the things that are actually required in terms of sacrifice. We'll hear from that from Roy Keane a little bit later on to make it at the top. So Gregor, I'll start with you on this. I'm virtually blaming the players there. I do think now they've got no place to hide. I'll say that. How much do you think they're to blame?
Look, they deserve criticism because, as Tom said, that performance was woeful at the weekend, and there have been several performances like that. I can understand frustration when you kind of when you don't quite have faith in the manager and the sort of the way you're being sent out to play, and you know we've highlighted before when Manchester United have been asked to press and they're running in ones and twos and it's not coherent. They've not been coached properly to do it, so I can understand there's frustration that, and that can rub off on your kind of body language and you know just your general belief in the way you're being sent out to play. But they need to perform a lot better than that. The one thing I would say is, you know, there's been a lot made about how good this squad is, and you hear pundits talking about, you know, man, this is a really strong Manchester United team. They're the second most expensively assembled squad. Just because the second most expensively assembled squad does not make them of a level of Liverpool, of Chelsea, of City. The other thing about Ed Woodward's reign is they've overspent and misspent hundreds of millions of pounds. So this is an expensively assembled squad. They're playing well below their capabilities, but they're still nowhere near the level of the three best teams in this country, or kind of, you know, going deep into the Champions League. That's a fact. We've seen evidence of it. And there are players who have been signed for huge sums of money who have woefully underperformed. Again, I'll come back to it. Part of that is to do with the team they're in, but part of it is because they're not the players that they think they are, and Manchester United thought they were.
What do you think, Tom?
They've also been signed for the wrong reasons a lot of the time too. We have to say that. You know, Ronaldo, Pogba, players who are kind of big presences on social media, big kind of
marketing.
Figures, market. Yeah,
yeah.
That's underpinned a lot of the transfer activity that Manchester United have done, and you know we're seeing the result of it now.
Yes, spot on. I agree. And the Ronaldo one is particularly interesting because Paul Hurst's written a really great piece in Today's Times about how it unraveled for Solskjaer, and one of the things he reports on is the fact that Solskjaer and his coaches thought, well, when Ronaldo was announced, great, yeah, we've got this goal scorer, but we've spent the past 2.5 years, 3 years building a team that gradually has pressed more and pressed more and pressed more, a little bit, you know, that was what they were moving towards. And they get the striker who goes totally against that, who removes that. But that's only a small part of this. I mean, I think what was key in what Gregor said was that these players clearly felt that Solskjaer wasn't the right man. And that was... The performance of Vicarage Road showed that entirely. In fact, I even thought it started at Leicester. It was that game, and the performance against Leicester was just night and day between the two sides. And the four goals that Watford score in that game, there is no challenge is made from a Man United player. That was what shocked me. There's not even an attempt at a challenge in any of them. No one's near it. The indiscipline, the lethargy, it's been going for a long time. And the problem was, the reason why I think, because it also feels a little bit quite knee-jerk, I think, because there's no one lined up to replace Solskjaer immediately. It feels quite knee-jerk.
Well, that almost underlines how badly the club's been run.
Yeah, an international break where you've got the time to do it. And everyone knew it as well, because the issue with the Watford game is that you've had Leicester, you've had Liverpool, and you've had City, where they go into the game sort of, you know, strutting around, thinking it's the old United, but truly everyone knows it's not. Everyone knew that especially Liverpool and City were superior. Watford, wow. I mean, they hadn't scored in four of their last five games, and they absolutely batter United. And of course, they make teams look so much better than they are. The same happened with Villa, wasn't it? Villa's last win before the run of five defeats was United. I think the problem is we will see, I was going to say we'll see a reaction. The problem is that, as Paul puts in his report, what's actually changed now? Because the problem for the players is that even before Solskjaer, when Solskjaer was there, he was the manager, but maybe fitting in with the old Fergie style in the final years, where he would step back and he'd be on the sidelines and McKenna, Carrick, Phelan would do the coaching. So what's changed? What's actually changed?
And the answer is nothing at the moment, but it will change maybe very soon, or maybe in the summer, depending on, it seems, Mauricio Pochettino's wants. Should Manchester United be waiting until the summer to replace Solskjaer? Because I've got to say, as a Manchester United fan, people will say, well, who's available? And you sort of say, well, there are some jobs in world football where people just become available, don't they? They know their opportunity to coach a club as big as Manchester United might come once every 5 years or once a decade. And so, you know, you start seeing the stories in the papers of people who are interested. And the club, listen, as far as I'm concerned, as a Manchester United fan, we've wasted enough money on players. If you need to pay to get someone out of their contract or play to get a group of coaches out of their contract, Manchester United have it and should be going after their number one target aggressively. But I don't run Manchester United yet.
You've made a good pitch, though, over the past few months. You've made a good pitch, you.
So my question to you guys is once again, should United be waiting until the summer for a permanent replacement for Solskjaer? And who would you pick to replace him? Tom, do you want to go first?
Sure. Do they wait until the summer? Well, no. No. Partially because of what I just said. The problem is I don't see a lot changing immediately because not a lot of nothing's
the same coaches are there.
Yeah, same coaches are there.
So they need a big change and they need it as soon as possible.
And I mean, I would probably go for Pochettino, and I actually see Rodgers and Pochettino as potentially very similar for what they've done at former clubs and why they would be attractive to Man United, because they build cultures, they develop players, and they have been successful at doing that. The question mark over both of them was trophies, which both of them have delivered. Now, the one reason that I would go for Pochettino over Rodgers is the reaction that you would get from probably players and definitely fans, because Pochettino would, I think he's a sexier name right now, and I think he would inspire players and fans much more. But I actually think they're very similar, and I think both of them could work.
They need a change now, absolutely, for all the reasons Tom's outlined. It's just remarkable that Manchester United have got a caretaker before they appoint an interim, and there's, 26 games left or something in the season? Like, I don't know how you can kind of write that amount of a season off, almost. So if you can make a permanent appointment now and you can go all out for it, then do it. If you can't, then you need to appoint an interim manager who's going to ruffle some feathers and change things up a bit. And I agree, I personally, from the names that have been discussed, it's extraordinary about Zidane. Mm. You know, thinking about Zidane, in that the guy who's won 3 Champions League titles, La Liga, there's still so much we kind of don't know about him. You don't really know what he would bring necessarily as manager of Manchester United. Presence, yes. You could say that winning mentality, but you don't really know beyond that what exactly Manchester United would be under Zidane. So personally, for that reason, I think it would be a mistake. I agree. They need a cultural kind of reboot. The idea that Ole was the guy who was doing that was kind of false, because it was really harking back to past glories. You need to look to the future. They need a modern cultural reboot, and to become a modern functional football team. We've kind of already discussed about the bigger problems. I personally think whoever comes in is already fighting a losing battle, because I think the club's too dysfunctional. So good luck.
I tend to agree with you on that. You see the moves, if you like, the improvements that other teams have made. The innovation is the word that I'm looking for across the Premier League, not just the biggest clubs. Manchester United are currently a team in the past, and whoever they bring in needs to take them into the future and demand better training facilities, better coaching, you know, better analysis, better recruitment, of course. I mean, yeah, everything.
You know, they come out with the thing about Wan-Bissaka and how many right backs they looked over and all the data and analysis and whatnot. It's nonsense, and even if it's true, it didn't work.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're signing Cavani on a deadline day, and then Ronaldo. Like, this is not evidence of a coherent, well-planned recruitment strategy. So for that reason, as I say, whoever comes in is fighting a really, really, look, they can get more from these players. We've seen the impact when someone like of the caliber of Thomas Tuchel comes in. Instantly impact. You see his coaching, the evidence of that on the pitch from the players. You will get that from an elite coach, but you need more than that nowadays. You need everything. You need a kind of well-oiled cogs in the machine at every aspect of the football club, and Manchester United don't have that.
Who do you go for here?
Well, firstly, I'm just reading a bit of breaking news elsewhere, by not from the Times, that Ed Woodward could stay on as United's executive vice chairman, not just to appoint the new interim, but also the new long-term manager at Old Trafford, which as a Manchester United fan, not as a professional, I will say, would be disastrous. So let's hope that's not true.
You can say as a professional too.
let's hope that's not true for the sake of Manchester United fans. Let's call them that instead of myself. No, look, who should be the new Manchester United manager? I'm happy for there to be an interim until the end of the season. I agree with you, Tom, not from the current group of coaches that we have at Manchester United. They all need to leave. So whoever comes as an interim, I hope that they've got a coaching staff with them, whoever that might be. I don't know who would take it until the end of the year on that basis and bring 7 or 8 coaches with them. But again, Manchester United have the money. And I think the reason that I'm happy to wait until the end of the season is if that's the only way to guarantee you get an elite coach or as close to an elite coach as possible, then wait. Don't appoint someone now who's not right and waste another 3 or 4 years. That's all I'm going to say. So if you think, oh, I can only get Brendan Rodgers now and he's the best coach available right now, personally, as good a coach as he is, I would rather wait to see a higher caliber coach come in. I actually think Pochettino and Rodgers are in the same bracket as managers, as far as I'm concerned. They've both done very good jobs where they've been. They've both developed players, slightly different characters. The only reason I go towards Pochettino is I think his character suits Manchester United just a little bit more. I think the fans would like him and be behind him a little bit more. Of course, he's also not a former Liverpool boss, so that would help as well. I would love it if Manchester United were able to get one of the top tier of coaches, but they've gone now. Antonio Conte was the only one available. Manchester United dragged their feet and now he's at Tottenham Hotspur. So like I say, if they have to wait for Pochettino or even Rodgers, to be honest, until the summer, then so be it. But I would not want to see someone appointed that comes out of left field, none of us are expecting, but it's the available manager right now that they can get who hasn't got a job and they're just not good enough. You know, that for me would be wrong. But as I say, interim wise, there are some people I think that could do a decent job and they just need to be a wholesale change. We could talk about the players. I could sit here for the next 10 hours and give you an hour on each individual player. But the reality is, as Gregor said, too many of them are not good enough. And I think we got a false narrative about how good they were. I mean, you get it about a lot of players. People pick out one good part of their game and somehow say that they're a great player. Look, you know, Shaw's delivery. And you're like, okay, but his defence isn't great. Best left back in the league. No, he had a good bit of form. Tell the truth, Gregor. What was my one of predictions at the start of the season? Exactly. Luke Shaw isn't going to have a great season. I said in no uncertain terms. Wan-Bissaka, I've never backed. Lindelof isn't good enough. Harry Maguire isn't good enough. Matic is now too old. We never see Wan Mata, so I hope he's doing well. No, seriously. Fred McTominay, not up to it, let's be honest. Paul Pogba, a myth. Let's be perfectly honest. Bruno Fernandes, very good parts to his game. Some shocking parts of his game. He has a great assist or he scores a great goal. That's all we talk about. Not the full modern midfielder that you need. You know, he's an old school number 10. If Mesut Ozil's going to get slagged off for what he was doing at Arsenal for all those years, then because he didn't run back, then why is Bruno Fernandes being lauded? It's very, very similar style of I can run one direction, which is towards the opposition's goal, but not towards ours. I can't stand that. Jadon Sancho showed actually at the weekend in a couple of glimpses what he is very good at, which is that he picks out the perfect ball. He hasn't played much on the right-hand side. Mason Greenwood's been there. Give the guy a chance on the right-hand side. He's an out-and-out winger. He's a young player. Hopefully, he starts to enjoy himself. He's got a bright future. Ronaldo is Ronaldo. We know he has sensational parts of his game, but we know he doesn't press. So, as we said at the start of the season, you either change the style to fit him or you're not going to get the best out of the team defending as a whole. And they didn't. And I can go through the others. Most of them will be gone at the end of the season, so there isn't much point. But the reality is, that is not a squad that is going to compete or was ever going to compete with the likes of Chelsea, Manchester City and Liverpool. So again, not much point in going through it. Finally on this, big week for Manchester United. They've got Villarreal in the Champions League. They've got Chelsea in the Premier League. This is a pretty big audition for Michael Carrick if he's going to be the interim until the end of the season. Do you see Manchester United winning either of these games, Tom? Come, they've just lost 4-1 to Watford. I mean,
yeah.
No one's going to abuse you.
I was just thinking about the about if Solskjaer had stayed in charge and played against that Chelsea team on Saturday after the way they played against Leicester. And Thomas Tuchel, and that was one of the things as well. I mean, you see coaches like Thomas Tuchel walk in after a game like that and say there's space for improvement. And sometimes the United, the standards were just it was too celebratory at the moments. And I think I've said this before that the highs are too high and the lows are too low. And that's what happened in the that's what happened over the whole 3.5 years. This week, I think we see a performance against Villarreal because they have to. They absolutely have to. I think players will see their reputations on the line. At Chelsea, I just think it's too... Chelsea are too good of a team right now.
Yeah, I mean, who knows against Villarreal? But at Chelsea, I would say... No, the Chelsea were outstanding against against Leicester at the weekend, and I think they need a change. For all the reasons Tom said, that if you've got the same coaches in the dugout, they can change little bits and bobs. They can bring a player back. They can maybe bring in Donny van de Beek. They can bring in, I don't know,
Lingard.
But they won't have Maguire or Varane at the back, and Man United's options behind, you know, beneath that, are nowhere near good enough. So yeah, I think Chelsea will be a big another kind of wake up call for them. I think
It will be, an interesting week at Manchester United. They will dominate the headlines, as will their search for a new interim boss, permanent boss. I don't know what it's going to be. I'm sure they'll make their minds up by Friday. And we will reflect on all of that, I'm sure, when we next meet. But up next, we will get an insight into a former Manchester United captain. The Sunday Times' David Walsh has sat down with the enigmatic Roy Keane. He joins us next. Now, off the back of that remarkable news, or rather unremarkable news, about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, we are kind of going to continue talking about Manchester United, because there was an amazing interview in the Sunday Times this weekend with the former United captain Roy Keane, of course, the former Sunderland and Ipswich Town manager as well. I've even seen him linked with the interim position at Old Trafford earlier today. Not sure if you read this interview, it's going to be the job he's going to get. Let's speak to the man who has spoken to Roy Keane. The Sunday Times, David Walsh joins us on The Game. Hi, David.
Good morning.
I'm sure you'll get to why we're not going to see Roy Keane in the dugout at Old Trafford anytime soon. I wanted to start with the beginning of the interview, when you highlight that Roy Keane describes himself as a drifter, and that is all about him living in the UK. Explain a little bit more about that and why you decided to show us that window to his soul immediately.
Yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable thing when you've been in the UK as long as Roy Keane has been, which is like 32 years. And he goes back home to Cork. I don't know what the numbers are, but certainly once a month. I'd say there are times when he goes back twice a month. And he goes on the ferry, which is how he first came to the UK, on the ferry. And he loves travelling on the ferry. And he goes to Dublin and he drives down to Cork, which is a 2.5 hour drive maybe from Dublin. And he does that on a regular basis, stays with his mum, sees his old mates from Rockmount. He would tell you that his closest friends are guys he met on the Rockmount under 12 team when they were all kind of 10 and 11 year olds starting out on their journey in football. And he goes back and he watches the Rockmount team play, mixes with his friends, and it is a remarkable thing. And the point I was making to Roy when we spoke about it was he reminded me in a way of character in the Neil Diamond song "I Am I Said." You know, it's LA's fine, but it ain't home. New York's home, but it ain't mine anymore. I said, "Roy, are you like that man caught between two places?" And he said, "Yeah, I am drifter." He said, and I just think it's a very interesting dynamic. Roy would say that his kids and his wife regard Manchester as home. He can't, because Cork is always home for him. When he comes down the M8 from Dublin and he gets to the last roundabout before swinging right into Cork, he said the excitement he feels, the sense of being home. There's a remarkable thing about that journey back to Cork. Roy was born in Mayfield, number 88, Ballinderry Park. And his mum now lives a little bit out of town. And Roy, no matter what time he hits Cork at, if it's kind of 6 o'clock in the evening or 2 o'clock in the morning, because if he comes on the midday ferry, it'll be maybe 2 o'clock in the morning when he gets to Cork. He always drives up to Mayfield, back to the house where he grew up, which is no longer the family home. And he goes up and he looks at that house, looks at the church where he and Teresa were married, you know, revisits all those places the very first thing he does. And you know the way we say, you know, he hasn't forgotten where he came from. Well, when Roy Keane says that, it genuinely means something. And it's not only that he hasn't forgotten it, but he wants to see it on a regular basis to remind himself.
His views on sacrifice in elite sport maybe mirror the cold exterior we've seen from him on Sky Sports at times. Is that the athlete now still in him, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you interview Roy Keane, he tells you that in elite sport, he was an all-or-nothing person. It had to be 100% for the team. And he would tell you his family took second place to that. His friends took second place to that. He, you know, at a time when he realized it was hurting his career, he stopped taking alcohol. Just that's it. And for most of his career, then he's been a non-drinker because he wanted to get the most from his career. But when he's doing the interview with you, he's telling you this stuff. And the interview goes on. And you realize that everything he's got, he's giving to the interview. And that it's not that he's an all-or-nothing person in football. He's an all-or-nothing person in life. And I am pretty damn sure that now that he isn't an elite athlete, that if you were inside his home, I'd bet he's an all-or-nothing dad and an all-or-nothing husband. He's an all-or-nothing interviewee, and you put him on Sky Sports or on ITV when England are playing, and he's doing the punditry. And again, he's giving it everything he's got. I went back and looked at his punditry after the Man United City game, when City dominated United to win 2-0. Mm. And Roy never raised his voice. There wasn't a scintilla of anger. There was just sadness. And he said that he felt sorry for the players. And what he was saying was that they're not good enough to be Manchester United players the way they're playing now. And I feel sorry for them. And it was remarkable to watch it, because his sympathy was more damning than his anger. Because we'd seen the anger previously when United had underperformed. But now he'd been reduced to the point of feeling sorry for the players. And if I was a player, if I was a Harry Maguire or any player in that United team, I would have been more hurt by Roy's sympathy than by Roy's anger.
Manchester United fans might be surprised to hear that he said he feels nothing when he drives past Old Trafford, Manchester United Stadium. Why is that?
Before you say that, you've got to give it context.
I'm asking you to give it context, David.
The context is that he did say that, and he said he wondered, he suspected that if he were in Nottingham and he were passing the City ground, he would have the same feeling of emptiness about a stadium. Because he said it was the people he played with. That's the relationship that means something to him. He loves to see his old teammates on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. He'll drive up to if Salford are playing at home, he'll go and watch them play. And the reason he does that is a chance to have a cup of tea with Paul Scholes and Nicky Butt and Ryan Giggs and Gary Neville. And if he's not doing that on a Saturday afternoon, chances are he'll be back in Cork watching Rockman play. So he's got a tremendous affinity to the people he played with. But to the club, to a physical structure like Old Trafford, he doesn't do that kind of, walking in there and feeling this huge emotional charge. Because long before he was shown the door at United in a pretty cold and cruel way, he'd realised that it was a business, and there would come a time when he would be dispensable and he would be dispensed with. So his affinity is with the people and the relationships that have endured.
You speak of Salford there. It does bring something to mind. Do you think Roy Keane will ever return to football management? I know he said recently in an interview with Gary Neville that he would like to get back in. We don't know what that would be, but, you know, Gary might give him a call one day.
Well, my feeling is, yes, he would like to get back in. I think there's a good chance that he will. I mean, the thing we used to say about Roy Keane, it was a kind of a journalistic cliche, he divides opinion. And he still divides opinion. But the division is very different now to what it was when he played for Man United. Back when he was Man United's supreme leader on the pitch, all the people who kind of liked United loved Keane. All the people who didn't like United didn't like Keane. He stood for what they didn't like. Now he's no longer a United player. We see him on the TV quite a bit. Well, the divide might have been 50-50 in the old days. You only have to read the comments under any piece that appears on Keane, where he's been involved with the piece, like the piece in the Sunday Times yesterday. And you realise that 95% of the people here are expressing unbounded love for this guy and admiration for him. And, of course, it used to be like that. And I have a feeling that there will be club owners out there who perhaps will come round to the view that this guy deserves another opportunity. I mean, if you look at what he did at Sunderland, he actually managed well there. Sunderland did well. Ipswich was tougher, and it didn't work out so well. They got an amazing amount of draws in his first season, and it really hurt him. But I look at where those clubs have gone since Keane was there. They certainly were better when he was there. Sunderland in particular. And if you go through the comments underneath the piece in the Sunday Times yesterday, you'll see that everybody who professes an allegiance to Sunderland in the comment section says would love to have Roy Keane back. They absolutely love the guy up there because they feel that he understood the club, he got the area, and it kind of aligned with his own background and his own kind of underdog spirit. And so I would hope that he would get back in, because you kind of feel with Keane that there is a great manager in there who just maybe needs the right opportunity.
David Walsh, real pleasure to talk, and we could keep discussing Roy Keane for a full hour as well, but it's a brilliant interview. Check it out right now from the Sunday Times, of course, but you can read it on the Times app at the moment. Roy Keane, I love this as well, the quote used in the headline, "I'm way down the pecking order in my own home. Even the dog tells me what to do." I love it. Thank you very much, David Walsh. Up next on the Game Podcast, we'll discuss the new manager bounce.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, there were three new managers in the dugout this week in the Premier League, and I'll say there was a positive start for all three, although some might question that assessment. Let's begin with Aston Villa, who immediately looked a more aggressive and hard-working outfit under Steven Gerrard. Gregor, what do you think was key to their 2-0 home win over Brighton?
A moment of brilliance from Ollie Watkins, basically. I think Brighton dominated large parts of the game until that goal. You're right in that Aston Villa looked organised and disciplined, but it was fairly kind of workhorse stuff until that moment of brilliance, and it was a moment of brilliance. Great kind of composure to play out of from their own penalty box, and Ashley Young to carry the ball forward. Brilliant through ball, and Watkins kind of confidence to cut inside and shoot rather than slipping El Ghazi. So yeah, that was just a kind of, that was liftoff, wasn't it? It was a moment that, you know, you saw Gerrard tearing off down the touchline, and it was kind of, that was like a new manager bouncing microcosm there. It was like, that was a big moment, I think, right in front of the whole end. So no, I mean, personally, I wouldn't read too much into Villa's performance. I think, as you say, they were organised and disciplined, but I think there'll be a lot more to come in terms of Villa's playing with the ball, because that was a breakaway and a moment of brilliance that really won the game for them.
Go ahead, Tom.
I don't want to carry on harking on about United at all, but one of the things with Solskjaer throughout the whole time was his lack of in-game influence. And with Gerrard, we saw it immediately. I mean, Danny Ings was a summer signing, excellent summer signing, but he wasn't influencing the game. He brought him off, and that was part of the result in the change. And you saw small, subtle differences. I mean, I think Ollie Watkins was playing wider out left, and they were certainly it was quite modern as well. The wing backs were heavily involved. I think one player that we're going to see, I've been really impressed with him already this season, Jacob Ramsey. They've got a great player there. And sometimes it's easy to fall into these sort of cliches, but you know, Gerrard and what he did at Liverpool, having someone like him as manager for Jacob Ramsey will be huge. And we could see him certainly flourish even more this year.
Gerrard, speaking after the game, sort of remarked on his celebrations for the goals as some kind of indication that he doesn't see Aston Villa as a stepping stone. He was like, well, you know, if anyone doubts me, just look at the way I celebrated the goals, which I found pretty odd. I mean, you are the Villa manager. I'm sure you want them to win games. But there you go. They did get the win. And as I said, I think they were, you know, they were more aggressive. There are more of their players blowing, let's put it that way, than there were under Dean Smith. So clearly he said something to get a little bit more effort out of them. But Brighton did dominate large parts of the game. They were a bit toothless in front of goal again. 7 games without a win in the Premier League. And that is a team that we thought, you know, was going to do pretty special things. Top 10 finish at least. Just not clicking right now, Gregor.
Yeah, I mean, look, Brighton's start was outstanding, and you see all the kind of, you still see all the hallmarks of Graham Potter's team. They dominate against almost every team they play in the Premier League, and they go toe to toe with the biggest clubs. They did against Liverpool, so there's still a lot to be, you know, very positive about if you're a Brighton fan. But as you say, that was their issue last season, getting, you know, applying that final touch. And if Trossard's not quite on song, if Maupay's not getting the goals, you know, there's not much behind that. They need to find that kind of killer touch, I think, in front of goal. And that's the difference between Brighton having a really successful season and having a season of just surviving.
Yeah, there were shades of 2020 Brighton in that performance. Let's talk about Norwich City. They're off the bottom of the table. They've had back-to-back wins now. Dean Smith this time leading the Canaries to a 2-1 win over Southampton. It's the first time they've come from behind to win a Premier League match since May 2016. Billy Gilmore, Gregor, back reminding us why he's got a pretty bright future.
Yeah, I mean, it was an open goal, wasn't it? Who kind of just put Billy back in the team, and he was outstanding. The way he drives forward with the ball as well. Everyone talks about the way he kind of, you know, he's quick passing move. He's a little fulcrum in the midfield. But sometimes, if a space opens up, he drives forward with the ball and makes things happen. So, yeah, he was at the heart of a lot of what was positive about Norwich's play. But you have to also give them huge credit when, you know, you think the season Norwich have had and the kind of ordeal they've had in the Premier League, and going behind, I think in 3 minutes, was it? You know, to kind of show enough kind of steel and character to come back at Southampton, I think they deserve a lot of credit. And although you have to say McCarthy for Hanley's goal was a bit of a gift.
The one thing I do think with Norwich is that I don't think, even though, you know, the bottom of the Premier League, I don't think there were foundations there. They were always, whenever I saw them play, they were always effective in the middle third. They just could not defend, and they were never clinical in front of goals. That was the issue. So there were foundations there for this. I think Eddie Howe has
pretty
that.
Weak ones by the sound of it.
Yeah, but I think Eddie Howe has probably the hardest job out of the three. The biggest transformation needed. With Norwich, they play attractive football. It just hasn't been effective, and I think they're quite feeble, really, physically feeble. You know, they go into these games, and why we saw Brentford have such a good start was not only the fearlessness, but the physicality they have. I think Norwich have always been a pretty weak side. So there are, I know the record is extremely poor, but I do think there are foundations there.
I put Cantwell back in as well, and then that one didn't quite work. You know, he's not played since September. He's been banished to the 23s. You know, I think we'll see more of Cantwell. But that was an easy way for Smith to change the atmosphere, just to say this is a clean slate. We can forget everything that's gone before, and we've got two hugely talented players that we can put back in the team. One of them worked, one didn't, but I'm sure we'll see more from Cantwell too.
Norwich off the bottom. Southampton very wasteful, you've got to say, in that game as well. Gave them an opportunity, but they are off the bottom of the table, which means Newcastle are now rock bottom, the richest club in world football. I don't know if you knew that. Eddie Howe, their new boss, had a positive COVID test. That meant he missed their 3-3 draw with Brentford. But I guess we did get an answer as to whether they're going to be gung-ho like Leeds United. I wonder who suggested they should do that. 23 shots at St James's Park. The commitment to getting bodies forward, Tom, did meant there was a lack of getting bodies back.
Yeah, it was quite a surprise to see him stick with the five at the back. I know it wasn't totally a five at the back. It was more a traditional three and wing backs. But I think that was meant to sort of provide a bit of protection. I don't know how long we'll see that for, but yeah, I can't imagine how hard it is to actually manage a game. He was meant to be in touch with Tindall throughout the game, but how in the hell you manage a game from a hotel room? But we saw out of the three, we saw the biggest change in a performance. Bringing in Joelinton was a bit of a gamble in itself, but paid off. He was certainly, from this game, probably the biggest beneficiary of all the players. And again, we saw what I was talking about before, the influence in a game. He went how changed to three up top by the end, and that influence that led to the equaliser. It's what he's promised. It's what he promised he and had to deliver. I mean, anything, if we didn't have this amount of shots, if we didn't have this amount of attacking football and adventure, then you'd wonder what the point was. But it's I think he's got certainly the hardest job on his hands out of those three.
What did you think of the game?
I mean, some of the defending was calamitous. I think that's, I said it before, I think that a lot of that is about individuals. I think he's got to, you know, there was a quote, a stat in Martin Hardy's piece today that I think of the last 15 players that Newcastle signed, I think it was like £148 million and only £30 million of it's been spent on defenders, and you can see it. Like the caliber of player he has to call upon at the back is not really good enough, I don't think. So that's undoubtedly where he's going to have to strengthen in January, because some of the goals they conceded were awful. But what you saw was a lot of attacking intent. You saw bodies in the box. You saw, you know, four or five Newcastle players in the box every time a ball was getting delivered. You know, players pouring forward in numbers. And another beneficiary is undoubtedly going to be John Joe Shelvey. He's spoken about that openly, that a player of his ability who can sit in front of the back three or four and dictate play a bit like a quarterback is going to be important for them. And Shelvey's like a top class player. He's just been ill disciplined at times, and he's struggled for fitness at times. I think if you can get a song out of him, it's going to be important for Newcastle this year.
The way that Newcastle played, is that a recipe for success for them getting out of the relegation zone? Or do you think if they continue to play like that, they'll actually get relegated?
I mean, I don't think that. Look, we said last week that let's see them be on the front foot. I don't think they're going to be gung ho all the time. I think this is a 3-3 game, and you can say, yeah, obviously it's his first game, and is this a blueprint for Eddie Howe's Newcastle? He won't want it to be. It's just the goals they conceded were so bad. But undoubtedly, he's going to. It's a change. It's a change from what's gone before in terms of both Bruce and Rafa Benitez before him. It's going to be a more attacking outlook. The most important thing is they need to strengthen at the back in January. And if they do that and they play the kind of attacking football that we know that Eddie Howe is going to want from them, then I still believe they can survive because they have got goals. And a lot of it's going to depend on keeping Sam Maxima fit as well, of course.
Yeah, I thought he was very good once again. Finally, before we go, we've got to talk about Saturday evening at Anfield. There was a distinct golfing class as Arsenal were swept aside by Liverpool. The 4-0 defeat gave us a clear indication as to where Arsenal are really versus the very best teams in the Premier League as their 10-game unbeaten run in all competitions came to an end. Tom, many felt the most annoying part of this is that Arsenal actually started okay. What do you think was key in this? Was it more about Liverpool's greatness or a weakness from Arsenal?
A little bit of both, really, but probably leaning further on the side of Liverpool's greatness, really, because the Arsenal's results this season back up where they are in the table. They've played against, they've lost against City, Chelsea, and Liverpool. And of course, and Brentford, of course, on that opening day of the season, which you could call an anomaly in a way, a sort of a freak in the way the wind was blowing.
And it was a totally different team on that day as well. Yeah,
exactly. And Brentford's first game in the Premier League. But this it amazed me to see there was a stat about since Klopp took over. I think they've played 16 times Liverpool, and only 4 times have they lost by fewer than 3 goals. Yeah. And that is the golfing class that you're seeing there. And we talk about the work in progress that Arsenal and Arteta have and are doing. And I think the problem was possibly the results in recent weeks, the unbeaten run, the winning run, maybe made them believe that they were closer than they actually were. And this reality check was used a lot on Saturday night, but it was a reality check. It was a reminder of where they are in the process, but it's not a moment to panic in any way, because that's just Liverpool are, they could very much win the Premier League title this year. They are a far superior side at the moment. And Arsenal are one who have bought key players in the summer. Tomiyasu, Ramsdale, who obviously had an excellent game. And it's beginning to work. But this is just a reminder of where they actually are.
I thought the way that they approached playing against Liverpool was complete madness. I thought they tried to play out from the back against the most, you know, fearsome pressing outfit probably in world football, and time again they maybe got 3 passes and then lost the ball, and there was just constant turnovers, and the pressure that, you know, that built up, it was ultimately the reason why they lost. And
17 turnovers. Liverpool won the ball more than any other game so far this season.
Yeah. So, like, I understand that a manager has a deeply ingrained belief in the way that his team should play. And also, it kind of, when you veer from that, sometimes your players maybe start to doubt, you know, how deep that belief is, how true that belief is. Mm. But I don't think Arsenal, they're not at that level yet. They're not quite good enough to do it. You know, we see Man City are probably the only team who can, when Liverpool are totally on song like that, can just about cope with it and play through them. I don't really think there's any other team in the Premier League who can. So, you know, there's other times when Arsenal have played against Liverpool and some of the top teams, and the way they've mixed the play up since Arteta's been manager has been their strength. Kieran Tierney's balls, I think, sometimes down the flank for a spinning, you know, for Aubameyang spinning in. I think of the FA Cup, is it semi-final? Is that against Chelsea? I can't remember. Anyway, that kind of ball, you know, mixing your play up is what is so important. But Arsenal really did not do that at all. They're just constantly trying to play it from the back. Centre-half's trying to drive through, trying to drive through and just being completely swarmed. I thought it was complete madness, really. And they were swarmed. They were absolutely swarmed. As Trent Alexander said, there was kind of red blur all around Arsenal. And it was a wake-up call, really, for the gulf that still exists between Arsenal and Liverpool.
Finally, before we end the podcast, a very important question. Who would win in a fight, Mikel Arteta or Jurgen Klopp? Tom?
What is it about Anfield that gets... wasn't it at Anfield where Pep Guardiola had his moment with the two fingers in the air?
Just Lampard too?
Yeah, Lampard and Klopp. I don't know what it is about Anfield.
I think Arteta would fight dirty, to be honest. I think maybe like fingers in the eyes
poke,
and stuff.
Yeah. Did look like that.
I can't see past Klopp. Wow.
Can't see past Klopp.
No.
He's gone more aggressive. He's lost the glasses now. So clearly he's preparing for a scrap, doesn't want to get anything in the way. But those veneers, I mean, come on, he's going to want to take care of his teeth more. So I don't know, you know, I just don't know. But I'd like to see it. So if they could get a charity fight together for Christmas, that would be awesome. They had a little bit of a laugh about it afterwards. But I don't know. I enjoyed it from Mikel Arteta. I enjoy it when people, you know, because I think there's a little bit of, you know, too much respect for Liverpool after what they've done over the last few years. Jurgen Klopp, as much as I love him at times, sometimes he's not very respectful either. So you know what? When people give it to him, I'm happy about it. It should happen more often. If you go away to Anfield, you know, get stuck into that. It's not even just Jurgen Klopp.
It backfired, though, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's just a fight. I know. It did backfire massively. It basically galvanised the Liverpool team completely to go and destroy Arsenal. But look, it could have happened anyway. So, you know, I don't know. Listen, Gregor Robertson, Tom Roddy, thank you for being with me for the past hour or so. Thanks to David Walsh as well for joining us a little bit earlier on. Thank you, too, for listening. We'll be back on Thursday reacting to everything that happens in the Champions League, including Manchester City versus Paris Saint-Germain. Man, we'll also look ahead, of course, to Manchester United's game against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge in the Premier League at the weekend. But of course, remember, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast, The Times and The Sunday Times for more of our award-winning journalism. If you sign up today, you'll get yourself 1 month free. So go online, check it out. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you soon.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.